All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is the heroic Dar Jamail, unembedded reporter from the last Iraq war, author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and also a co-author with Chris Hedges of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's now writing for truthout.org, and this one is at tomdispatch.com, the great Tom Engelhart's site, tomdispatch.com, and we also ran it under Tom's name at antiwar.com. It's called How America's Policies Sealed Iraq's Fate. Welcome back to the show, Dar. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. Always good to be with you.
Very good to have you here, and we have a limited amount of time. Usually we go a full half hour. But we've only got about a quarter hour to spend, so I will just let you go and tell this story of the American legacy in Iraq, I guess contra the theory that, oh, you know how those people are, always fighting over who's a Shia or not. But you've been back to Iraq in the not-too-distant past here, and obviously have a lot of experience about that country going back to the start of the war. So please, fill us in.
Well, essentially, this what we're seeing in Iraq today is the legacy of the U.S. invasion and occupation. I'll run through it as briefly as I can, but we have to, you know, we can't talk about what's happening today without good historical context, as with any story. But this is particularly so with Iraq. We go back, fast forward or fast rewind back to just prior to the invasion of 2003. Iraqis said, look, there was sectarianism, there was stuff there that Saddam exploited, but by and large, you know, we had a large percentage of marriages between Shia and Sunni. We grew up in neighborhoods not knowing if our neighbor was Sunni or Shia. It just wasn't an issue. Enter the U.S. invasion, and immediately the sectarianism was highlighted and exploited. I remember interviewing a religious sheikh in Bakuba, and he said, look, 3 weeks after Baghdad fell, so we're talking about late April, early May 2003, he said a military commander came and showed up in Bakuba and set up a big tent and invited all the tribal and religious sheikhs to attend. And then when we did, he said, okay, we want Sunnis on one side and Shia on another. And that's how it went. And then fast forward a bit to late 2004, when it became clear that resistance was so intense against the occupation, both between Shia and Sunni, we had some collaboration starting to happen between resistance fighters in Fallujah and members of Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army militia. And then there were demonstrations in Sadr City in solidarity with the people of Fallujah. And then later on that year, when the U.S. started attacking Sadr down in Hilla and around Najaf, actually fighters from Fallujah were helping them out with weapons, mm-hmm. with helping the Sadrs out with weapons. Right. So we had a unifying situation between resistance groups against the U.S. occupation. So the U.S. decided to bring in Negroponte as ambassador of Central America fame under Reagan, Death Squad fame. Brought in his old cohort, Steele, retired Colonel James Steele. They set up and started running the primarily Shia militia death squads. And then that set in motion all the horrific chain of events with the 2006-2007 sectarian bloodlettings. And then the U.S. brings in, around that general time frame of the occupation, of course, Maliki, and installs him as dictator, despite him not winning the majority vote that had occurred. And Maliki then comes in and immediately starts targeting Sunni, extremely sectarianism. That set the stage for Sunni protests that began in late 2012, carried on every Friday through 2013, where they were protesting because government forces were regularly coming into places like Fallujah, predominantly Sunni areas of Baghdad, detaining people, killing them, torturing. It was around, actually, 06, 07, 08, we started to see large numbers of Sunnis turning up in Maliki's prisons. This was unearthed by some reporting at the time. Horrific things. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty both were writing very condemning reports against the Maliki regime for his treatment of Sunnis. And then these protests were going on through 2013. I witnessed the boiling rage. I attended one of these that I mentioned in the article that I just published with Tom, being on stage with community leaders, basically religious and tribal sheikhs of Anbar province, on stage on a highway that outside of Fallujah. They shut down the highway between Amman and Baghdad. And they were basically, the crowd was mostly really young, angry men from Fallujah and other parts of Anbar. And these sheikhs started saying, look, give us a little more time. We're trying to use diplomacy and politics in Baghdad. We don't want to have this escalate. And people were so enraged. They wanted to fight so bad that we had to literally evacuate the stage because they started pelting it with water bottles and rocks. And they just wanted to fight. And then out in the crowd, you could see, I have pictures of it, you can see the black flags of ISIS waving. So very, very fertile recruiting ground. And so that is why when this lightning attack, these lightning takeovers of cities, starting with Mosul, began, and literally within weeks, a huge section of the entire country had been taken over by ISIS. That's why, because they had public support, they had sympathy, because they were actually taking the fight back to these forces that had been for several years at that point persecuting Sunnis. And so that's basically the why this happened, why ISIS has been so effective. Now, of course, what's happening is it's going in another direction. That's another situation. If we talk about their brutality and, you know, them trying to institute extreme Islamic law in these places and exert taxes and convert Christians and all of this kind of lunacy. But the bottom line is this kind of extremism was there was fertile ground for it because of Maliki and because of the unbridled support that the U.S. kept giving him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Patrick Coburn from The Independent talks about ISIS and their view of Shia and compares them like they're Nazis looking at the Jews, where the Shia are so beneath contempt to ISIS that their intent is, at least when they get the chance, to carry out their final solution. That's how horrible that they are on even the existence of the Shia. But then he says, just like you, this started out a difference of who's on whose side for power. And that was how you had the different coalitions of Sunni and Shia, and as you say, all under American occupation and supervision. But then now it has become a situation where, after all, the most fundamentalist and ruthless fighters are, in many cases, certainly in Iraq's recent history, the most effective ones and then the most effective leaders. So you have the people running ISIS after now a decade of America destroying that society. It's not just about, you know, who's on whose side and who's getting the oil revenue and this and that. It is about blasphemy and heresy and the kinds of things that can't be reconciled, because of America's legacy there, as you say. And I don't know if you agree with that or not, but that was the way he puts it.
No, that is right. And that's the information I've been getting too, that they are beyond radical. And that is how they personify Shia. And that's why we see these horrific things. I mean, if you follow Human Rights Watch, there's been several reports they've done interviewing people at length about what they've seen, what's been happening, and just really, really horrific stuff.
All right. Now, let me rewind a little bit back to what you were saying about under American occupation and Muqtada al-Sadr twice in 2004, as you say, allying with the Sunni uprising in Fallujah while he's in Najaf and in East Baghdad, and them allying back with him again. During this whole time, Robert Dreyfus did a lot of great work around that time, etc. Sadr wanted what he called a government of national salvation, which would be an alliance with the Sunnis. We're all Iraqis first. And so, this could have been prevented. Not that Sadr's the greatest guy. And later on, of course, his militia was responsible for a lot of the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, of course, against the Sunnis. But back before that, 2004, 5, even into 2006, I think, he was trying to make that coalition. Why didn't America let him do that? Why did they choose the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, Maliki and his cronies, instead of Sadr, among the Shiites, who were the majority who had won in the democracy, the Shiite coalition party, the United Iraqi Alliance?
Three words, divide and conquer. I mean, it's by you describing the name of Sadr's Unity political party that he was hoping to bring into reality, that would completely undermine the U.S. goal of divide and conquer, and then have a government structure, a parliament structure set up in Baghdad, not unlike that in Lebanon, which basically renders it completely impotent. That, you know, it's so factionalized and so fractioned that there's no way they're ever going to be able to have a unity government there that really serves everybody fairly. And so that's why the U.S. has always been so dramatically opposed of against Sadr, and then kept the Sunnis marginalized, because there's been a large portion of the Sunni population that wanted the same thing that Sadr did, as far as that kind of a united political force in Baghdad. And so they bring in a guy like Maliki, who is extremist, and that he's going to take the Iran line all the way down the line. He's going to buy however many tens of billions of dollars of military training and weaponry that the U.S. wants to sell them, and then keep the door at least cracked for U.S. access into Iraq's oil fields and at least certain parts of the country. So he was willing to play ball. He was the useful tool, the useful idiot, and he's come in, and that's why he's enjoyed U.S. support up until now. And now I'm sure the U.S. they're literally looking for someone else to try to replace him, although, of course, Maliki's not going to go quietly into the good night.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of seemed to me like he played them, too, telling George Bush, oh, yeah, I want to let you have 60 bases and all this. Let me go talk to the guys and we'll work it out. And then came back and Bush, you know, the clock was ticking on Bush's presidency. He had to sign the Status of Forces Agreement. And Maliki said, sorry, no immunity deal after the end of 2011 and the expiration of the UN mandate. Sorry, no bases for you, Bush. Sign. And so it seemed to me like he was really playing them more than they were playing him. And really, you know, they thought, well, he needs us, so he's got to keep us. But like you said, he's with Iran. It was Sadr who wanted to marginalize the Iranians and the Americans. And so all America did was put Iran's guys in power, and then they kicked our ass out. I mean, you're right, he's been buying our planes ever since and that kind of thing. But I mean, a few guys at the embassy is not the same thing as 56 permanent Rumsfeldian lily pad bases over there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's totally right. And I mean, it's been clear from the very beginning that the U.S. went into this situation geopolitically playing checkers, where Iran has been playing chess from the very beginning. And that we're seeing this played out now. You know, Iran has literally taken over the entire southern part of Iraq without having to have any direct overt military involvement whatsoever. And the same can now be said for, of course, their control over the vast majority of Baghdad. You know, they have just simply been playing at a higher geopolitical game than the U.S. and the West. And, you know, of course, you look at the machinations and the complete incoherence of the U.S. government, both under Bush and now under Obama, and that's no surprise at all. I mean, another thing that we have to mention is that ISIS doesn't exist without what the U.S. is doing in Syria, that directly and indirectly they've been getting arms and funding and support into them, either via them or Qatar or Saudi, and created this monster of ISIS in Syria to go against Assad. And that's another reason that they're as strong and as effective as they are. And that needs to be mentioned, too, how the U.S. Absolutely. Is effectively funding and backing both sides of this war.
Right. Yeah, and in fact, it's such a blatant contradiction that even people on TV news are sort of scratching their head about it and talking about it out loud, about how ironical it is and that kind of thing, when they start to put it together. Well, wait, so Assad is against ISIS, right? But then, and Assad is allies with Maliki? You can see him figuring it out live on TV sometimes, yeah?
That's right, that's right. I mean, and it is extremely confusing, but at the end of the day, if you just look at where the U.S.'s support is going, it helps it become less confusing.
Right.
And then, of course, you bring in the fact of, well, who's making the most money off this in the U.S., what kind of weapons contractors, et cetera, what's Israel's role? And so that all of that adds up to start clarifying it pretty quickly, and it becomes pretty cynical.
Yep, and of course we've got Mitchell Prothero at McClatchy Newspaper reporting from Erbil and saying that they're rebuilding and expanding the CIA base there. There's no secret about it, and that the Joint Special Operations Command, the CIA, and probably just regular SOCOM 2 Rangers as opposed to Delta, you know, but they're building up in Kurdistan right now. So, and drones are flying, and it's already on, Dar. I don't know why the carpet bombing hasn't started yet, to be honest. I'd have thought it would have started by now, but thank goodness it hasn't. But it doesn't look like anybody's stopping it from being about to happen.
Yeah, this is still, I think, in the beginning stages of where this conflict's going to go and how much worse it's going to get. I don't see how there's not going to be some kind of massive military adventure launched against ISIS in that country. And it also makes sense. The U.S. has to maintain some sort of a stable foothold in the country. And basically, at this point, Kurdistan is all they have left. Baghdad is gone.
All right, that's it. I'm sorry we're all out of time. I can talk to you all afternoon about this stuff, but thank you so much, and we'll do this again soon for sure.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, everybody, that is the heroic Dar Jamail, unembedded reporter from the last Iraq war, now covering this one for Truth Out and TomDispatch.com. He's the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, which is great, and The Will to Resist, Soldiers who refuse to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. And that's it for the show, everybody. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Scott Horton here for Anti-War Radio every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. You can find my full interview archive, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org. And you can follow me on Twitter, @ScottHortonShow. Thanks very much for listening. See you next week.